Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and the law firm of Garfield, Kelly & White, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
And hello, this is Neil Garfield, and this is Thursday, January 8th, 2015. Happy New Year to all of you, and thanks for pushing us over 10 million visits on our website. Homeowners are winning, and I will give you some info on that and take some questions at the end. Those legal presumptions used in foreclosure cases against homeowners are rebuttable, but you must do it right or you won't be able to do it at all. The law keeps evolving. The decisions keep evolving. The courts are showing in unsteady steps, but increasingly to the inevitable conclusion where the debts, the notes, the mortgages, the alleged sales of mortgages are mostly shown to be a huge fraudulent scheme. Just this week, Patrick Genta, who is my lead counsel in foreclosure defense and other matters, he and I tried a case and won in foreclosure defense on multiple grounds, showing that the foreclosing parties had pushed the homeowners into foreclosure without any right or reason. It was a big win, and we will give you more details once the decision is published. But I'll give you a summary of the decision, my summary of the decision tonight. I'm broadcasting live from Boynton Beach, Florida, brought to you by the Living Lies Blog, GTC Honors, and GAR, the Garfield firm with offices in South Florida. And this show is specially brought to you because of donations to the Living Lies Blog from listeners just like you. Thank you. And a special thanks to all the lawyers and other people who are reaching out to me now from across the country and, in fact, from other countries, sharing ideas, pleadings, and strategies. The tide is turning. Lawyers are picking up the torch and running with it. I'm proud to be a member of the legal profession, and that pride does extend to hardworking judges who are trying to master the most complicated scheme Wall Street has ever come up with. For those of you who are not contributors to the blog, we ask that you call 954-495-9867 and pledge whatever you think you can afford. Even $5 per month will make a huge difference for thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. A little goes a long way. Call 954-495-9867 or 520-405-1688. And pledge whatever you think you can. If you get voicemail, please leave a message. Our mission here is to share as much information as we can to help beleaguered homeowners and other people who may not be aware of the effect the housing crisis has had on their lives. If you have lost a job, are being paid less, or you're losing benefits, it's most likely caused, at least in part, by the banks who suck the life out of our economy. We have concentrated almost exclusively on mortgage loans here, but soon we will be turning our attention and our fire to student loans, credit card debts, auto loans, and other consumer loans that have been subjected to false claims of securitization. If you are a homeowner who was lured into a deal that couldn't work based upon blatant lies told to you by people who knew better and who knew you would believe them, then you're in the right place. And then, of course, there's the big lie. You have to be 90 days behind to be considered for a loan modification. That's the bank's way of telling you to go pound salt. Stop paying, we will promise a modification, and then we will disapprove you for modification, even if you make the trial payments, and we'll still foreclose on you. That one is backfiring against the banks all across the country. And then there are other issues that were corroborated by the ruling that Patrick Junta and I received at the conclusion of trial on Tuesday. So now the truth is coming out. Those of you who follow my blog know that I am posting an increasing number of cases in which the trial court, the appellate court, or both have found not just that no evidence to enforce the fabricated note and mortgage, but now have even found the debt void and going further, in one case ordering Bank of America to refund all the money paid to them because they had no right to collect it in the first place. That might be the next step in the case where we tried the case on Tuesday. So tonight, I thought I would share a few details before the decision on Tuesday is published in final form. One of the new tricks that are being used by the banks and servicers is to bring brand new documents with them to trial that nobody has seen before, probably because they didn't exist until they were fabricated. It seems they're becoming aware that they have a problem enforcing these worthless notes and mortgages, and so now they are using a document called the Limited Power of Attorney or Limited Power of Appointment. It's another facially valid document that really means nothing because the grantor under the power of attorney does not have any rights to the loan. In our case on Tuesday, the opposition tried to come in with two different powers of attorney than the ones we were shown in discovery. Patrick immediately objected, and his objection was sustained. That meant that SPS didn't have the power to represent the trust or Chase, the prior servicer, or anyone else. SPS was unable to establish that it had the authority to service the loan account. And the court found that they did not have that authority. SPS was unable to establish that they had the authority to represent the trust, U.S. Bank, or the holders of the certificates, which somehow made its way into the style of the case without a formal amendment. Which brings us to another issue that was created by whoever is really the prime operator behind all these strategies for the banks that are being conducted simultaneously all over the country. You have to watch them closely. Change the style of the case from U.S. Bank as trustee for a corporation or a trust, depending upon how you read it, to U.S. Bank as trustee for the holders of the certificates, which they... Of course, they never produced the certificates, nor did the holders give them any right to represent them in a foreclosure proceeding. But the interesting fact that did not come out at trial, but I think will in future cases, is that the holders of the certificates actually are the only ones that do have a direct interest in the debt, because in most cases it was their money that was used to fund or acquire the loan directly, as opposed to the money going through the trust. The corporate representatives of the other players had already run for the hills because they didn't want to be targets for a wrongful foreclosure lawsuit. So nobody from the trust, the prior servicer, or even the alleged seller under the pooling and servicing agreement appeared. Just what I call a robo-witness who knew virtually nothing. And while the court initially gave some credibility to this witness, it quickly became apparent that neither he nor SPS, for whom he was the corporate representative, had any knowledge, nor had their so-called boarding process vetted any errors in the records of the prior servicers' accounts. And that, of course, was J.P. Morgan Chase. The evidence included an unsigned pooling and servicing agreement, which included a cutoff date for the loan to have been acquired by a trust through purchase of the debt from J.P. Morgan Acquisition Corp. I have seen several times where the document sought to be introduced as evidence is not signed and obviously is not the final document, and obviously not the best evidence of whatever the document purports to be. Yet, many judges are letting those documents into evidence where the bank offers them, but giving homeowners a hard time when they have similar documents that they want to offer. An important piece was the judge's findings that the assignment dates and endorsements were not credible. This is another way of saying that they were backdated, fabricated, and worthless. Those are my words. The evidence did not include any evidence of a transaction in which the trust actually purchased a loan for value, much less that such a transaction was completed before the cutoff date. No effort was made to show that money exchanged hands. The PSA was relied upon by the plaintiffs as authority for filing the foreclosure and as proof that the loans had been purchased by the trust. The court found that none of the entities variously identified as plaintiffs or representing the plaintiffs ever acquired the debt, note, or mortgage. And once again, I remind you that the devil is in the details. Plaintiff failed to establish a credible default date. The court found that the default letter was wrong as to the existence of a default, wrong as to the alleged date of the default, and clearly wrong as to the amount required for reinstatement. That created a defective notice under paragraph 22 of most mortgages. And the court further found that the witness for the plaintiff, while personally credible, did not have adequate information to answer the simplest question about the loan account. The boarding process that the court initially presumed to be adequate to establish the records of the prior servicer, Chase Bank, later proved to be not trustworthy or credible, with multiple default dates of July 1st, August 1st, September 1st, October 1st, all in the same year, unexplained. And the court noted that after preparing for multiple trial dates, the sole witness, who I call the robo-witness for the plaintiff, could not answer the question posed by the court. It was the judge who said, "What was the default date?" After waiting and waiting for an answer, the judge noted that it had taken 11 minutes for the witness, who was still analyzing the report generated by Chase, the previous servicer, whose records had been boarded by a so-called stringent audit by personnel of Select Portfolio Servicing, claiming to be the successor to the servicing rights on the alleged loan. During that period, the witness gave three different dates for default and four different dates for the last credit to the borrower's account. The last date he gave conformed with the testimony of the defendant, sole witness, who said that her last payment was on the same day that Chase records showed processing for that payment, which also turned out to be the same date that Chase sent out a default letter. Then the amount demanded for reinstatement. You got to look at that carefully and see whether the numbers add up. It was clearly wrong in this case and could not be explained by the plaintiffs. Regardless of what figure was used in the default letter, none of the amounts could be reconciled with even common sense. The court found the default letter was wrongly prepared and presumably sent to the defendants, the homeowners. Thus, the conditions precedent in paragraph 22 of the mortgage were not satisfied by plaintiff or any related parties prior to the suit being filed. And, of course, the court found that the loan never made it into the trust because of the absence of a credible assignment and endorsement. Nonetheless, the plaintiffs or their representatives, Chase, elected to accelerate the entire debt due as stated on the note and mortgage. And the court found that the acceleration and the default letter were wrongfully prepared and that the foreclosure of the mortgage was accordingly also wrong. The Chase records on handling of the escrow payments was also picked up on by the judge on her own. The reversal in the records for escrow purposes could not be justified since the monthly payments admittedly received by Chase included principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. Other entries of payments, reversals, and transactions relating to insurance could also not be explained and would indicate that Chase at least had been negligent in the bookkeeping and accounting of their own posting of entries into the loan account for the subject loan. So both the records of Chase, the prior servicer, and the boarding process, they call it, the auditing process, sometimes they call it, of the subsequent servicer or alleged servicer, SPS, both of those were shown to lack credibility, and as a result, neither one was entitled to be considered as proving the amount due or proving the default. And in this case, the defendants had contended that they were current at the time that the default letter was sent. And the court reserved jurisdiction to consider entitlement and amount of fees and costs to be awarded to the defendants. We'll be taking questions in a moment. That's a little note to my producer, Bob. On the fees and costs to be awarded to the defendants as a prevailing party, the new pleading requirements over the last several years make it imperative that you plead for fees in your answer and affirmative defenses if you want to get fees and costs awarded. Now, it used to be that the request for fees and costs was asking for specific relief from the court, and it was not necessary to include it in the answer and affirmative defenses unless you were filing a counterclaim. Now that is very different. There is a Florida Supreme Court case, and there's a couple of other cases that have cited that in the Stockman case, which indicate that even if the other side pleads for fees and costs, whether they waive it or not, it doesn't make any difference. If you want to recover your fees and costs in the litigation, then you need to plead that you want fees and costs if you are the prevailing party. So I think that you get a flavor here of what happened this week. There is also another case which I heard about by telephone from New Mexico, which was, if not identical, very similar to the findings, which are very broad in the case that we won this week. And we, of course, have reported other cases from bankruptcy judges and so forth that have had broad impact on the enforceability of these documents, which are not based on the actual transaction in which money exchanged hands. This whole thing is an illusion. And for judges and other people to get their minds around that is not easy to do. It's unfair to judges and to attorneys, for that matter, or borrowers, to think that any of these people should be aware of exactly what the banks are doing. What the banks are presenting is a case that looks like a regular foreclosure that, you know, was from yesteryear. They did not get the idea that these foreclosures might be defective, fatally defective, and totally wrong. And that's why there's been wrongful foreclosure cases filed and sanctions, even in the foreclosure cases that were filed, that amount to millions of dollars on mortgages that were $200,000-$400,000. The awards have been upwards of $13 to $20 million. There are also many other decisions, or I should say settlements, which conform to what I was just discussing, in which the borrower, as in the case this week, is essentially the winner and probably will be able to get clear title and has an excellent chance of wrongful foreclosure and potentially payback on all the payments that were made. There are a number in the hundreds that I know of where I was directly involved, and thousands that I've heard of, perhaps tens of thousands of cases, in which the settlement precluded the parties from being able to talk about it. So even where I was the expert or consulting attorney or whatever, I am unable to give you details on those other cases. This case, at least at the moment, is not under any gag order, and it's not under any contract for confidentiality, so I'm able to talk about it in general terms. And our board is open for questions. If you want to signal us that you have a question, our producer will put you on the air. And in the meanwhile, let me talk a little bit about the interaction between the bankruptcy court and the state court. I think more and more bankruptcy lawyers, well, I know more and more bankruptcy lawyers are starting to come around to a point of view which they totally rejected back in 2008 when I addressed the bankruptcy bar in Phoenix. I said that the schedules filed in a Chapter 7, Chapter 11, or Chapter 13 bankruptcy petition should not necessarily list the amount allegedly due on the schedules, nor should it show that the debt is secured. In the case we had this week, the debt is at least questionably secured. And probably not. God bless me. And For that reason, it's important that you, in my opinion, and obviously whoever your bankruptcy lawyer is takes precedence over me, but in my opinion, the entry on the schedules of saying that you've got this debt that's secured and it's owed to whoever you put on there, the servicer or the trust or whatever, that's kind of an admission against interest, and it's you're admitting to something that you don't really know is true. So that's step one. Step two is, in the motion to lift stay, there is a very low threshold for that motion to be granted, but there are a number of things that can be done to counteract that. And I believe, in my opinion, that bankruptcy counsel should associate with the attorney who is representing these people in the foreclosure action that is pending or should be pending in state court, either in a judicial state or in the non-judicial state where the homeowner has to file the claim. These two attorneys need to coordinate their strategies, and we can help them do that. So I'm being told that we have a 2-minute warning here. No, we have a 3-minute warning. And so I guess we won't be taking questions. I spoke too long. So the point is, A, what you take away from this broadcast, number one, homeowners can and do win. It's not just a matter of we know who the bad guys are, we know how to beat them. And by we, I don't mean just me and the lawyers I work with. I mean there's a lot of lawyers across the country who are doing it, and they're doing it well. And secondly, bankruptcy may be an effective tool to stop the foreclosure proceeding from going forward, or a sale from occurring, and it may buy some time. But ultimately, what needs to be done is to bring to the attention of the court the fraudulent nature of the claim that is sought to be enforced. And third, that there are wrongful foreclosure causes of action, lawsuits, that can be filed whether the foreclosure is complete and long gone, as long as it's not barred by the statute of limitations. There are numerous cases in which homeowners have been awarded varying amounts for having filed a wrongful foreclosure action against parties who didn't own the loan, who didn't know the balance, and didn't account for various payments that they had received. Thanks for your attention. Good night, and I'll talk to you next week. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to the Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lies Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies, analysis, expert consultations, testimony, and declarations to use in your battle against the largest economic crime in human history. For information concerning Neil, the team at Living Lies, or the law firm, go to www.livinglies.wordpress.com or call 520-405-1688. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and should not be attributed to any other person or entity.